This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's a whole genre of movie and TV scenes that deal with the horror and humiliation of gym class. Like, say, this scene from the 90s movie Clueless, when Alicia Silverstone's Cher and her classmates are learning tennis in their high school phys ed class.
All right, Cher! Earth to Cher! Come in, Cher!
Oh my God. Ms. Stoger, I would just like to say that physical education in this school is a disgrace. I mean, standing in line for 40 minutes is hardly aerobically effective. I doubt I've worked off the calories in a stick of carefree gum.
Well, you certainly exercised your mouth, Cher. Now hit the ball.
My guests today might cringe at that representation. Physical educators today are trying to avoid gym class insurrections and kids standing around for 40 minutes doing something they don't enjoy and turning kids off to exercise and health. Instead, they're trying to work with schools and kids to align healthy habits and physical activity along with school curriculum needs and new state requirements. So today on the show, we're going to talk about physical education. We welcome your memories, but we're going to contrast them somewhat with what kids might be learning in today's school phys ed classes. Here to share with us are Lindsay Simpson, Physical Education Coordinator at the Vermont Agency of Education. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
And Betsy Caldwell, President of the Vermont Association for Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance. She's also a physical education instructor at the Newton School in South Stratford. Betsy, hi. Nice to talk with you.
Good morning.
And with Brian Godfrey. He's a physical educator at Richmond Elementary School. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Good. So we've been hearing from people throughout the last night and today about their memories of gym class. And I know, Betsy, you cringe at the word gym class because you think of gym as a place and you want us to think about physical education and joy. But a lot of people don't remember joy from when they were in school. Katie says she remembers trying to climb the blasted rope. I tried so hard, but my little arms would not carry me the whole way. Rich says it's a challenge for non-aggressive shy types, and to be honest, puberty is a tough time to be publicly naked for the first time. And Cisco remembers total embarrassment, humiliating gang showers, hashtag teenage nightmare. Cisco also adds, kids pick last made me feel so bad that I would volunteer to go last. Brian, let me start with you and say, you know, are the horrors and humiliations of gym class exaggerated in people's minds, or is there something to what people remember about how physical education worked in the past that you think is changing now?
I think it's changing a lot. I think we're looking at more the social-emotional aspect of PE, and really the ultimate outcome is to inspire movement, and the tools are the different games we play, and trying to look at the broad demographic of kids that we have in our classes and what are their interests and how do we engage them in movement.
What do you think, Betsy?
I totally agree with Brian. You know, when we look at our physical education classes today than what we remember, it's a totally different thing. You know, we have those memories, and those are what are in people's minds of the rope climbing, the dodgeball, the standing in lines. You know, our job now is to keep our kids moving 24/7 when they're in our class, you know, as much as possible.
Lindsay, can you talk about the goals then for what physical education is supposed to do for students? And we're going to get into some of the details, so we don't have to get really down into the weeds. But what's the overarching philosophy of why physical education should be part of the school curriculum?
I think what we really know is that as we develop students for entry into our workforce, we want to make sure that students have the health-enhancing behaviors to be thriving and excellent contributors when they're in jobs after high school or college or career. So what's important for exit criteria from physical education at high school level, for example, is that students really know how to assess their own fitness, how to drive a fitness plan that's personalized for them, and feel confident because they have competency in a broad range of skills to be able to go into the community and take care of themselves and be examples for others in their lives.
Betsy, do you agree with that? Do you see it as this part of the curriculum that's aligned with getting people job ready? Or, I mean, there are other values in being physically active, like it makes you more receptive to then sitting in a math class or an English class that may not be related to job skills, but may just be related to health and well-being and the ability to focus in other ways if you have that outlet and release.
Well, you know, our ultimate goal is so that we have movers that will move the rest of their lives. and that they come out into the workforce with those skills so that they're able to say, hey, I'm sitting at my desk for, you know, an hour. I need to get up and go get some water. I need to take a walk at lunchtime, you know, and when I'm done with my workday, I need to go and do a workout if I haven't already done one.
Brian, can you describe for people what, if I could morph myself back into an elementary schooler's body, what would I experience if I was in one of your classes?
I look at Richmond, and what we're trying to do there is create access to sports for kids who otherwise wouldn't have access. We're trying to have that positive first experience of movement that when kids experience a wide variety of skills, so trying to get kids outside. We work with Burton Snowboard, so they're outside snowboarding. They're going skiing. We're playing tennis and going to the golf course, learning to ride a bike. Next year, one of my big goals is to have swim lessons where kids would learn to swim in school. So we're creating access for all the kids who are kind of on the outliers, who wouldn't otherwise be doing some of those. And then as an adult, probably wouldn't just do some of those skills for the first time. So have as much positive first experiences in a variety of sports as possible. And then just have it be fun and have the kids really part of the creating the games and the excitement. So they're maybe instead of playing a game that you thought of when you were, you know, back when you were a kid, they're coming up with a new SpongeBob tag game or something that they're really engaged with. So you kind of connect it to that imaginary play. So that just makes it super fun and they want to do it.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I think it was called Octopus or something. You had to stand in one place and try to reach out and grab other people as they ran by. Is that similar to what kids might be doing in the SpongeBob?
Yeah, something like that. You can give them like all these like cool, you look in the gym closet, the PE closet. I can call it gym closet because it is in the gymnasium. But I look at, hey, you can have some pool noodles. You can have some different bean bags and, you know, we have this Omnikin ball, the giant, huge pink ball that's like a giant balloon that it just adds that extra element that makes it fun and exciting. And it can change a game that you did once and you can add new equipment and make it totally different. And then the kids are psyched to play it because the first time the game is fun, the second time so-so, and the third time you get a lot of behavior problems. So you have to keep switching it up to make it fun.
So there's some creativity and autonomy as well in your classes.
Yeah, and if you have the kids own that autonomy, that they create the games, it takes a lot of my plate having to go home every night and think about what do I want to play next week and say, hey, you guys create some of the curriculum. I'll help you switch around to make it fun.
Betsy Caldwell, what about your classes? You gave me a strange look when I said that you're a physical education instructor, but that is right, right?
That is correct. Teach? I went back to school this year, so I'm not formally teaching at the Newton School this year. My class is very similar to Brian's. You know, the kids arrive and they're active the entire time they're there. They're learning skills that they're going to be able to use for the rest of their lives. And having those experiences that are going to make them movers here in Vermont. They're outside all four seasons.
All the school, yeah, yes. Summertime. Okay,
three. Exactly. Yeah, having that opportunity to be outside and being able to take, you know, like, for instance, jump roping, taking a unit like jump roping and having that experience of learning how to jump rope and learning how to jump rope in class with your classmates, but then bringing it back into the classroom and bringing it into math class and bringing it into reading and writing and science, the science of all that, and being able to, you know, take that unit and the kids are going to take that jump roping home. And once they actually learn the manipulatives of that and the skills of that jump roping, they're going to do that for the rest of their lives. You know, and today with technology, I mean, they can look up videos on how to get better on YouTube. I mean, it's incredible. And we also have Jump Rope for Heart, which is a great fundraiser for the not only for our organization, but for kids that have heart problems and for adults that have heart problems.
We're talking today about physical education in Vermont, what new standards there are, how it looks perhaps different from what you may remember from your gym classes of the past. We'd love to hear your memories, though, or maybe what you see your kids doing differently now than what you did when you were in elementary and high school. And what questions do you have about how physical education fits in with the rest of the school curriculum? Give us a call with your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Greg, here he is. Greg, who actually has great memories because he says, I met my wife in high school gym class in 1980, so it remains my favorite class from high school. And Elizabeth says, not being a sports enthusiast and today only working on fitness, quote, because I have to, I have few fond memories of gym class, except for my first 2 years of high school with Mrs. Seymour. She didn't believe in climbing ropes and in kids choosing teams. She started the year with 2 weeks of easy workouts that seemed to us quite silly. Then she chose the teams based on her evaluation of our talents. We were outdoors in upstate New York more often than not until winter set in. Mrs. Seymour, who must have been in her 60s, could also keep up on a soccer or field hockey field with the best girls. So again, share your thoughts with us. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. Lindsay Simpson, I mentioned that Vermont actually has new standards across the board for what physical education is supposed to entail and what it looks like. And there's a lot of flexibility for schools, but what are the basic goals? I mean, you mentioned the overall overarching goals, but what's sort of specifically in these new standards?
I think what's really important for folks to know is that these standards really aren't substantially different from previous edition that we had called the Grade Expectations in Vermont. So these were revised by the National Association in 2014 and were just adopted by the Vermont State Board of Education. The goal, overarching goal, I would say, is to develop what we love to use the term of physical literacy, which is about developing student proficiency across a broad range of environments for self, others, and the broader community. So that definition really helps us connect back to the not only self, but in care of others as well, which is something I think is a really valuable shift.
How do you do that in phys ed?
Well, I think you heard Brian and Betsy both talk about opportunities where kids are working together in cooperative learning challenges, in design challenges in physical education. You heard Betsy talk about also opportunities where physical education tasks are intersecting with fundraising opportunities and awareness of challenges in the local community. For example, in my hometown of Waterbury at Thatcher Brook School, students in physical education are also engaged in gardening and harvesting for their own school food service program and in the broader community. So a lot of ways that I think physical education is advancing beyond just moving in that gymnasium.
A lot of schools, though, have different resources. And absolutely, since there is a lot of flexibility within the standards for what each school wants to do during physical education, that might mean that in some cases there are resources that the outside community can bring in. Some schools could have a climbing wall, but others don't. I mean, Brian, you were talking about skiing, and you've got Cochrane Ski Area, the community-owned ski area right in Richmond, right? So is that where you go?
Yeah, and Cochrane's has been great. I look at having the ability of, for $10 a kid, we can go skiing with equipment and have high-quality instruction. That's just, it is 2 miles from our school. So not every school has that, but it's looking at your local community. What do you have? Do you have a bike path? Do you have a lake, a pond, or something? And in Vermont, we all have something, and it's just being creative within that to create a program to teach fitness.
Do you see it that way, Lindsay? I mean, I can see some communities, though, saying we just don't have the same resources, and it may feel like sort of an unequalized system for physical education.
Mm-hmm. I think you could say that across the landscape of all education. It's really valuable that communities do have the autonomy to create their own local curriculum. What the standards do is say, but these are the non-negotiables. This is what we really want students to learn around, again, back to the adoption of these new standards. What we know is that they were built upon a research base that tells us that one of the biggest indicators of a student choosing physical activity post-secondary is that they developed competency in these skills. So we know that those have to be incorporated within a balance of also attaining what we call moderate to vigorous physical activity, so getting the heart rate and the breathing rate up. But then, again, as you said, back to the local control aspect, physical education teachers are taking advantage of what they have in their community, whether that's just an outdoor space that they teach kids to, okay, what can you do here and how can you create your own wellness opportunities outside of phys ed right here in our own hometown?
Betsy Caldwell, do you think or do you see in your experience that physical education is treated sort of fairly among all of the different parts of the curriculum and seen as an important part of what and how students are learning?
I think that's really up to the teacher, that physical educator that's in that school, and their ability to be creative, to build those partnerships and the collaborations with their colleagues And that's where their success is going to come. You know, for instance, Brian has an incredible collaboration, not only with his fellow colleagues in the building, but also with his building principal, which allows him, and this has happened with me in the past too, to be able to take the risks and to try new things. And, you know, in physical education, in your undergraduate PEAT program, which is physical education, teacher education program, you're given those skills and you're expected to be creative. Essentially, they can just hand you a sheet of paper and it says, just like what we do with the kids, and says, you know, here's this is the equipment you have. How are you going to be able to use that to be able to teach these standards? And you have to be creative. And, you know, it's not all about equipment. It's about the delivery and how you're able to, you know, assess that at the end and work with your other building colleagues and give kids these experiences that they might not normally have.
I know you bristle at the idea of calling it gym class or having somebody call you a gym teacher. Is that, though, because you still feel like you're pushing back in some way against either that image or that reputation?
No, I think it's just, you know, essentially, I'm a physical educator. That's what my job is. I don't teach about a room that has four walls and has padding on the wall. You know, I'm teaching physical skills and health skills that we're going to use for the rest of our lives. You know, sure, it happens in that four walls, but it's a subject matter that matters.
Well, and we'd like to hear from other physical educators if you feel the same way or if you'd like to share what kind of creative work you're doing in your own community and in your curriculum. We'd love to hear from you. Most schools are out by now. So if you have a chance, feel free to call in. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a comment. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about how we measure benchmarks and how do we know if students are getting the right amount and the right kind of skills from their physical education. And what might be different in high school? How do individualized learning plans come into play for physical education? Again, share your thoughts. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at changes to how schools are viewing physical education. You might still see some running and maybe even some of those presidential fitness challenges, though they're not required. But gym class is also being scrutinized for how it can help bend the obesity curve and foster skills kids can use for a lifetime. We're talking with Lindsay Simpson at the Agency of Education, Betsy Caldwell, the president of the Vermont Association for Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance, and Brian Godfrey, a physical educator at Richmond Elementary School. And we're hearing from some of you as well. We've been peppering in your memories of gym classes gone by. Some of them are funny, others are poignant, but many serve as a good counterpoint to what our guests today are trying to do. And if you'd like to share your story or ask a question about what is different for students today, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And let's go to Jeff, who's calling in from Williston. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the snowboarding and physical education program we've been working on for 2 years. We developed it with Allenbrook School in Williston, and then Brian and I have been working together over the past year and a half, and it's now gone globally. We have the program in 10 different countries, and I've done about 50 sessions over the past 2 years in all those different locations, and it's something that it's very exciting, and having teachers like Brian to work with who are very creative and innovative, it's really changing the game, and I think kids are more engaged, and living in Vermont, being able to snowboard inside the classroom and then take it outside in the winter is pretty amazing, and we were able to do that. We took the kids from Brian's gym for a couple weeks to the playground and the soccer field and then up the Cochrane, so it was really cool.
Jeff, thanks for calling in, sharing your thoughts on that. Sounds like you've been pretty intimately involved in how that all works. Brian, do you see the kids that you work with responding to being able to go snowboarding in school as part of what they're doing in school and seeing that as a positive thing?
Yeah, I look at something that was new and exciting. And you know, about a year and a half ago, I didn't know Jeff at all. I saw some work he had done on the news, thought it was really cool. I'm like, I would love to do that in Richmond. I don't have any money to buy anything or anything. So I called him up. He called me back and said, he gave tons of equipment. He's been a him and Burton Snowboards have been a really valuable asset to our school. But I look at before we came, and if I would ask kids who thinks they're a snowboarder, maybe two or three kids, you know, in a class would raise their hands. Like, I've tried it. I don't really see myself as a snowboarder. And now, last year we had kindergarten through fourth grade. All the kids learned how to snowboard inside on, you know, these boards that Jeff designed with kind of like felt covers on them. And then he gave us like real snowboards, helmets and boots for all of our kids to snowboard outside. And now you ask kids like, who thinks they're a snowboarder? And at least half the kids are saying, hey, I'm a snowboarder. Or the other half is saying, hey, I'm a skier. And it's just creating opportunities for kids that they wouldn't otherwise have. And it's something as an adult, like, you can snowboard and it's fun. And if you're not into team sports, you can do it and have a good time. And it's been nice to connect with someone like Jeff, who's really passionate to get that opportunity for our kids.
And let's go to Robert, who's on the line with us from Proctorsville. Hi, Robert. You're on.
Hey there. Yeah, I've got a pretty simple idea, and I, you know, I'm sure you've heard it before. My experience is kids, when they're younger, they go out and play soccer, and they're just swarming around a field, and they're all participating and keeping active. And as they get older, when they need activity even more, schools start to become more elite in their ways of having, you know, varsity soccer, eliminating a lot of kids from participating. And I guess my point is, you know, really making intramural sports more important than competing against other schools will keep everybody on the field active and having fun.
Robert, thanks for your comments. Betsy Caldwell, what do you think about that? How do schools better incorporate that kind of physical learning for everybody?
I think it needs to be a plan that the school has. It has to be a mission that a school works on. It's not just the athletic department and the principal coming up with this idea. It needs to be a total school-wide mission that everyone has a part of, and, you know, getting the students involved in planning that and making it come into fruition.
So do you see physical education as sort of complementary with the competitive team sports that a high school might have, so that they actually work in connection with one another? Or are they somehow like, you know, you're either on a team or you're doing the phys ed because you don't want to play the sports?
Oh, physical education and competitive sports are two totally different things. You know, competitive sports, you're focusing in on, for instance, soccer. You're focusing in on soccer and just soccer. You know, there is the components of physical education in, especially physical fitness, in soccer. But in physical education, you're learning a little bit of everything. It's like a potpourri. You're putting everything into the pot.
Lindsay Simpson, how do you think about phys ed fitting into physical activities of all sorts in schools?
I think this is a really great point that physical education quality PE is really, we hope to be at the center of a school-wide physical activity plan that is comprehensive. And so I see it as a complement to competitive after-school sports, and the caller just alluded to. We do have to really attend to the wishes and the interests of all students, not just those who want to be competitive athletes. And the State Board of Education recognizes this, such that in April 2014, we have a new regulation in Vermont that all schools need to provide 30 minutes of physical activity every day for kids in K through 12 that is outside of physical education. And so, you know, there's a lot, again, a lot of local control about how they do that. It doesn't have to be 30 minutes consecutive. It could be broken up. It could be a movement break during the classroom to reinvigorate the brain, as you alluded to earlier today. We know there's a great research connection between physical activity and learning readiness. But it might look like an after-school club or activity that is non-competitive to engage those who wouldn't otherwise choose the competitive sports offering.
Lindsay, you're with the Agency of Education. How do you then figure out if schools are doing the right amount of physical education, if it's working? I mean, what do you use as benchmarks to determine success in phys ed?
So, again, the local system of assessment, it really should be looking at that in a team cross-supervisory inter-school district way. those teachers should be working together to be looking at the standards and deciding as we move towards a proficiency-based system, what are the desired outcomes of high school graduation, and then looking backwards using the standards as a guide for how you're going to progress that learning and designing a whole assessment system that evaluates how students are learning and then how that'll knit into each student's personalized learning plan, which is another aspect of the changing landscape in education here in Vermont. So the Agency of Education doesn't that's not my role to actually do that evaluation locally. It's my role to support that work locally with resources. So, for example, these national standards are also directly aligned with a whole body of assessments called PE metrics from the National Association that schools can now also use in conjunction with this resource. That's another reason why the State Board of Ed really felt good about adopting these as a preparation tool for a proficiency-based system.
Brian Godfrey, how do you measure success?
It's hard to judge because every kid comes in at a different level. So we've talked about team sports. And getting back to our last caller, we look at really there's a financial separation in kids' opportunity to access a lot of these sports. So whether it be, usually it's soccer, gymnastics, basketball, hockey, that kids start at a young age, they play normally year-round, have high-quality instruction, but it costs a lot of money for the high-quality instruction. And by the time they're getting into middle school, they're really proficient in that one sport. Well, some of their peers who maybe don't have the financial backing to, travel in these all-star teams or whatnot are having the same opportunities. So it can be a little tricky to say, hey, we're going to do a soccer unit, and I have a kid who's playing, on a traveling soccer team who's better than I am, and then another kid who's just learning to kick a ball. And I try to break it down to the fundamental skill. We're teaching jumping, hopping, skipping, kicking, throwing, shooting, whatever it is, and looking at that progression, but not attaching that skill necessarily to the stereotypical sport you normally would, and then have a bunch of other fun, exciting games that I can kind of manipulate the rules so that it can be fair and challenging for everybody.
Let's go back to the calls. Nelia is on the line with us from Lindenville. Hi, Nelia. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
I just wanted to speak a little bit more to the value of taking physical education outside of the classroom. Your guests have already talked about how that really helps develop lifelong physical skills. And we are a K-8 school that has programs in taking our kids off-site to go swimming and ice skating and cross-country and downhill skiing. And I think beyond that lifelong skill, you're doing a couple of other really valuable things for your school and your students. You're building relationships with community resources and you're role modeling that for students. So we're really glad to share that. We have Kingdom Trails in our area, Burke Mountain, Linden State College, and we really like to take that opportunity to teach the students about those resources in their own community. And then also you have the chance to involve parents in the lives of the school and in their children's education and in getting to know their children's peers when you involve them as chaperones and have them come along. But most importantly, I think you're providing unique opportunities for students to learn in mixed age groups where they can really patiently lead and support each other as they take on those physical challenges and learn about them from each other. Of course, there's varying skills there.
Nelia, yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. Interesting to hear what's happening in Lindenville. Sounds kind of similar to what's happening in Richmond in a lot of ways. And let's go to Louise, who's with us from Bromont, Quebec. Hi, Louise. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling concerning the classes you're giving in gym. I was brought up by the nuns in French Canada, and they were after the Swedish teachers, and we were taught rhythmic dance, this type of, exercise. There was nothing involved in, team sports and that sort of thing. And I believe that long-term, team sports are very, well and good, and skiing and all that, snowboarding. But let's be real. People in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond do not do that. I'm 71. I'm 5'5" and I wear size 4. All my friends are in their 50s, and they are having tummy problems, weight problems, and all the rest. I do my weights at home in my jammies every morning, and I do Body Flex by Greer Childers, who you probably know of, an American woman, and I stay in shape. So we have to be realistic. Real life is time short, takes 20, 30 minutes daily, and team sports are well and good, yes, if you want to participate, but the reality is not that.
Well, Louise, it sounds like you got great skills from those French nuns and in lifelong healthy habits. And it sounds like for our three guests today, that's really what you're trying to instill in people. So, you know, we started by doing a little tongue-in-cheek memories that people have of their gym classes. What do you hope that the kids that you work with today would call in with 30 years from now to talk about their physical education? And Betsy, we'll throw this one your way.
I hope that my students would remember their experiences in the classroom and that they would share those with not only their families, but with other kids, and that they would take those skills and use those skills for the rest of their lives.
Brian, same for you?
Yeah, I want to kind of inspire a foundation where kids as an adult will grow up, love movement, hopefully not have some of the preconceived notions around exercise that some of us do from our experiences, and to share that with their families and kind of make a generational shift in how our culture is suffering from the obesity epidemic.
That's Brian Godfrey. He's a physical educator at Richmond Elementary School. We've also been talking today with Betsy Caldwell, who's the president of the Vermont Association for Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance, and Lindsay Simpson, physical education coordinator at the Vermont Agency of Education. Thanks very much to all three of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jane.
This is a thrill.
Coming up, Calvin Coolidge lives. Well, he lives on in spirit through Jim Cook, who's ending his 30-year run as a Calvin Coolidge impersonator this weekend. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For the last 30 years, Jim Cook has been putting himself into the shoes of one of Vermont's most well-known historical figures, the 30th President of the United States, Calvin Coolidge. Cook is a Coolidge impersonator, and this 4th of July will mark his official last performance as Silent Cal. He joins us now on the show. Jim, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be here.
Coolidge is not the only historical figure that you impersonate, but what made him appealing to you?
The fact that I was from Vermont, I think, was a great appeal to me. I had been cast as Coolidge in a play, and as we rehearsed, I began to see that Coolidge was not the simpleton that our history books have said he was. Then, after the play was over, people would give me books about him, collections of his speeches. And especially in his speeches, I saw that what he had written, what he had said, and he wrote his own speeches himself, all of them, those were wonderful words and very, very appealing to say them.
How does one actually get a job working, though, as an impersonator rather than as someone who just admires the speeches?
You kind of self-select yourself to do that. I mean, nobody, it's kind of a joke. No presenter, no producer anywhere ever has woken up in the morning and said, I wonder where I can find a Calvin Coolidge. That doesn't happen. It probably still won't happen.
But you have been able to find work as an impersonator. I mean, I imagine it's not your only source of revenue, but you've for 30 years been doing this work as Calvin Coolidge. Anywhere other than just the Coolidge homestead?
Oh, he's taken me all over the country. In many instances, I've gone to places where he went. For instance, in 1927, he spent the summer in South Dakota, and in that period of time, he dedicated the work about to begin on Mount Rushmore. It was, in fact, the last time that a president traveled on horseback to deliver a major address. Recently, I was in Florida in retirement. Coolidge spent a month in Mount Dora, Florida, at the Lakeside Inn. And I've been down there the past 3 years researching that interval of time. It's a period of time that nobody has written about, but I think that there's real insight that can be gained about the character of Calvin Coolidge. And, of course, I've been to many presidential libraries all over the country, in the Reagan Library, Lyndon Johnson's Library, well, the Kennedy Library, which is right next door to me. And I damn near got to, can I say damn?
Yes, you can. I think that's tolerable.
Okay. I nearly got to Cuba. Calvin Coolidge is our only president who visited Cuba while in office. And there was a time when there were some people who were interested in getting him back there. In fact, they were hoping that they were going to get Ben and Jerry's to donate ice cream and President Coolidge would give it away. But 9/11 happened, so nobody was going to Cuba for some while.
Well, plus the historical inaccuracies of that are just mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes.
Jim, how do you prepare for a performance?
Well, I tend to immerse myself in the character as much as I can. I have a few things that connect me to him. Like, he always carried a picture of his mother. And I have a picture of his mother, too. And I have it in an old cigarette case that belonged to my mother. And I have a couple of Indian head buffalo nickels of the Coolidge era. And that's always been my favorite American coin. And they take me back to the 1920s.
Hmm. Does getting into period clothing make a difference as well?
Oh, of course, of course, of course. Yes, it does. I mean, a hot day, Coolidge would in nearly every instance be wearing a jacket and tie, a suit and tie. And, I mean, I've done the same thing, and people will say, well, aren't you roasting in that? And to a degree, I am, but You just accept it as what is necessary.
Well, you've studied Coolidge's speeches and his way of speaking. Would you mind giving us a little passage that you particularly like or that you think more people should know about?
All right. I was born on the 4th day of July in a 5-room story-and-a-half cottage attached to the post office and general store, of which my father, John Calvin Coolidge, was the proprietor. This, of course, was in Plymouth, Vermont. My father was successful. He trusted nearly everybody. And sometimes people would return and pay him their bill, and he never thought he was going to see him again. That's
it. Was it difficult to learn the accent? I mean, you grew up in Vermont. You must have known at least a few people who still spoke like that.
Except, I mean, I grew up in Vermont in a tiny village, Waits River, which is a tiny village between Bradford and Barrie. And, of course, the Vermont accent was very powerful, very strong then. And I know that that what I'm doing is just kind of generic stage Yankee. Back in Coolidge's time, you could tell which side of a mountain a man came from the way he spoke. You can't do that anymore.
So what do you think people should know about Calvin Coolidge? Because I think it's obvious that you admire a lot about him, and people do think of him sometimes only as Silent Cal, to the extent that they know him at all. What are they missing?
Well, that he was a man of extraordinary honesty, integrity. He did what he said he would do, and if he didn't say he was going to do it, he didn't do it. He's just so unlike what we view as a political figure. Dwight Morrow, who was Calvin Coolidge's friend at Amherst College, it said that he introduced his old college friend, Calvin Coolidge, to his wife, and said, this man has a tremendous political future. And Mrs. Morrow said later, she said, that man has no political future whatsoever. He wasn't pleasant. He didn't shake anybody's hand, slap anybody on the back. He didn't tell any good jokes. He has no future in politics. Well, Anne Morrow, who, of course, we know married Charles Lindbergh, Anne Morrow was, I don't know, she was 9 or 10 at the time, and she said, well, I liked him. There were all these men in the room, and he is the only one who asked me, how did you hurt your finger? It's always been my goal to say what he said, repeat what he wrote, and not to think in terms of, well, I wish he'd said this, to stick to what the facts were.
No editorializing on your part, then.
You got it.
The Coolidge Homestead always hosts a big celebration on the 4th of July weekend, which was, as you pointed out in your previous passage, also Calvin Coolidge's birth date. What are you going to be doing this weekend?
Well, I'm going to be doing my last solo performance of Calvin Coolidge. The title of my performance is Calvin Coolidge, More Than Two Words. And that spins off the most popular Coolidge story, which I believe is true, where I think he was vice president. He was seated in Washington next to a garrulous lady who grabbed his arm and said, "Oh, Mr. Coolidge, you must talk to me. I've made a $5 bet that I can make you say more than two words." He turns to her and he says, "You lose."
But you will be giving more than just those two words this weekend.
I certainly will, yes.
Well, Jim, congratulations on 30 years as a Coolidge impersonator, and good luck this weekend in your last solo official performance as Calvin Coolidge.
Thank you. If you find your way near Plymouth, you come on in and see it.
Jim Cook lives in Quincy, Massachusetts, and if you'd like to catch his last performance in Plymouth Notch this weekend, we have a link to the Coolidge Homestead up at vpr.net. You've probably tried to forget the term Deflategate. You know, the question of whether or not the Patriots and their star quarterback Tom Brady knew that their footballs had been deflated slightly before the AFC Championship game this winter. The league report on the incident, the Wells Report, said probably they did know. But a second report, analysis by AEI, a public policy research institute, said the Wells findings were flawed. At the risk of bringing back bad memories, we're going to talk Deflategate one more time with Mike DeSarno, a biostatistician at the UVM College of Medicine and a lifelong Patriots fan. He wanted to sort out the conflicting findings. Mike DeSarno, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Okay, so the AEI report, often held up by Patriots fans, said that the initial league findings couldn't be replicated. So you set out to see if you could replicate them. You are, after all, a biostatistician. And you found that you could?
Exactly right.
So what did you find? I mean, it sounds like you just said, yes, the Wells data can be replicated, and that's what AEI had said, nope, can't be done.
Right. So one excerpt from the AEI report that the media really picked up on was that their replication of the report's analysis found that it relies on an unorthodox procedure at odds with its methodology. And so based on that excerpt that I saw, I took the data set that Wells used and ran the appropriate analysis method on it, and I got the exact same results that Wells did. My actual intention of doing this was hopefully to find out I couldn't replicate it because that would be in the Patriots' favor.
And you are a Patriots fan.
Exactly. And so when I could replicate it, I didn't really like that too much.
And what you were replicating exactly, this had to do with how much the balls were inflated or deflated. It was all about PSI, is that right?
Right. It was looking at whether the pressure drop for the footballs was different for the Patriots footballs and the Colts footballs.
Okay. And so basically what you found was that what the Wells report said could be replicated. That doesn't mean that you agree with the Wells report's findings, though. Where do you think there are flaws?
Well, that's also true. So when I look at the results of the analysis that I ran, it finds that there is a difference in the pressure drop for Patriots balls versus Colts balls, but the drop in the Patriots footballs is exactly as predicted by the ideal gas law. The ideal gas law states that pressure will decrease as temperature decreases. So the pressure drop of the Patriots footballs exactly matches the drop predicted in the Wells report. It's just that the Colts' pressure drop was less, and that's most probably due to the fact they were measured at a higher temperature. They were allowed time to warm up.
So, Mike, do you have a theory then? Do you think the Patriots and Tom Brady did do something nefarious?
I do not think they did. I just think that the footballs were at the minimum allowed pressure, and during the game, with lower temperature, they dropped a certain amount to below spec.
And you think the Colts balls were not at the minimum allowed pressure, and that's why they decreased less?
Well, they were slightly higher temperature to start, but they're measured at halftime at a higher temperature. And so they showed a smaller drop.
I see. But short of someone ever fessing up to it, do you think we're ever actually going to know what really happened?
I do not think so. There's just too many unknowns in the data. For example, the data as to what pressure gauge was used when is unknown, and the pre-measurement data is also unknown. They just plugged in estimates of the pre-data.
Mike, you're a biostatistician at the UVM College of Medicine, so this isn't part of your real job. You just sort of did it for fun, I guess. And from what I have been hearing, you haven't heard back from AEI about how you could replicate the findings in the Wells report. But are you angling for a new job, say, with the Patriots or the NFL here?
Not at all. I'm happy where I am. But that's a good point. AEI did not reply back.
So anything you do want to have come from this research you've done?
Well, yeah. I was just pointing out they use the completely incorrect analysis method. That doesn't change the fact that the Wells results were also inconclusive.
Mike DiSarno is a biostatistician at the UVM College of Medicine. Thank you so much for talking about your work with us.
My pleasure.
And that does it for today. Vermont Edition is taking tomorrow off, but you should tune in anyway to hear VPR's Live from the Fort special. Our own Rick Singeri will be your host for an hour-long special featuring Vermont musicians who've played Live from the Fort, ranging from the punk of Ruff Francis to the country rock of Wayland Speed to the honky-tonk of Brett Hughes. That's tomorrow at noon on VPR. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.